I'd like to talk a little more about the third of the four right efforts, the developing. And I did say in an earlier talk here about how, yes, we should try to have a clear intention as to what our object of meditation is. And there is some methodical procedure to that object of meditation that we should not lose. And I added, the actual technique is not everything. It also matters what our morality was like, our sila. It matters how we took care of ourselves, you know. Every little thing like, did we sleep okay? Or, you know, did we eat healthy food? Or maybe we did some stretching or something, and now a tight muscle is more relaxed. So there's these, you might say, preliminary supportive conditions which can make our meditation a lot easier. It isn't just meditation technique on the cushion or, you know, walking meditation. And I want to speak more about what the suttas call Dhamma Vicaya, or investigation of Dhamma. And I'll I want to share a story here to kind of broach the topic, which is when I went to Asia for the very first time as a Buddhist monk. It was actually the first time to Asia in my whole life. This was back in about 2016. At the time, I had about 6 or 7 years of seniority as a Buddhist monk. But I had just been living in the Westerner monasteries. I didn't feel ready to come to Asia. I practiced in Canada and also the United States a bit, about 6 months, and Australia for a little over a year. And then I heard of this one monastery in Sri Lanka called Na Uyana. I met this Westerner man. He had practiced at Na Uyana. He had ordained there earlier and then had disrobed. And I met him in Australia, and he was telling me about the place, and he's like, oh, this Na Uyana, it's the biggest meditation monastery in all Sri Lanka. The most monks who meditate, you know, they're forest monks devoted to meditation. Na Uyana is, you know, the biggest in the whole country. And I was like, well, tell me more. And he's like, they've got this place called the Solo Retreat Area. It's at the back of the monastery, and monks who are more suited to kind of a solo practice where you run your own schedule and your own daily routine, they can go there if they trust you. You know, if the senior monks get to know you and they trust you, they'll let you go there. And the duties are pretty light. And, you know, there's maybe 10 or 15 monks who live there. And I'm like, really? That sounds awesome. I'd love to go there. And so myself and him, and there was one other Australian man as well who wanted to ordain, we all kind of banded together and we went to Sri Lanka. It was so cool. And it took us several months to kind of get this together, like with the airfare and, you know, how are we going to get there? We need a ride and everything. It was an adventure to get there because You're so lucky here in Malaysia. Your highways are great, your trains are great, buses are great. Okay, all your transportation's awesome. I love taking the train here. It's efficient, it's fast, it's clean, it's awesome. Okay, I don't know if you've been to Sri Lanka, but they would be jealous. Okay, let's just say that they'd be jealous. And now this ex-monk, I'm really fortunate to have met him because he knew some people. He still knew some Sri Lankans. And so when we got there, some contacts of his picked us up right from the airport, which was really helpful. Like we got off the plane, it was like 10 p.m. It's like dark out, you know. So anyway, I won't tell you too much of the story here. I'll run out of time. But that was an adventure, let me tell you. So so the next day we got to the monastery. The monastery is a 5-hour drive away, but it's so hard to travel in the country. We had to stay overnight, then go the next day. I'm not from their lineage. I'm from the Ajahn Chah lineage, but this other lineage is also a lineage who follows Vinaya rules, you know, very carefully, just as the Ajahn Chah lineage does. So they were willing to accept me kind of as an equal brother, because we had the same Vinaya rules. You know, we had the same kind of strict, you know, Vinaya. So after a couple of weeks, yeah, okay, they were willing to trust me. And then they let me go to the solo retreat area. I'm like, yes. You know, and this was like the best time of my life as a monk, for sure, the best. And that was like monk paradise. Now this was, I'd never been to Asia before, and it was major culture shock. Most of the Sri Lankans can't speak English. A very few of them could speak English. I got a really decent kuti because I had, like I say, the 6-7 years seniority. That helped to have some seniority. And I had this very nice walking path outdoors. And it was great. I went on alms round once a day, and then I had some chores for just 5 or 10 minutes a day, sweeping around this big chediya. And so I just did like sitting meditation, walking meditation, read the suttas. I had the early Buddhist texts there. At this time, I had no laptop, no smartphone. I think I had a Kindle. Yeah. And with the early Buddhist texts on the Kindle too. And one of the most frustrating things about my practice at that time is that when I would try to do sitting or walking meditation, my mind just would not settle down. Okay, these were like the perfect conditions I could have asked for. You know, the time to meditate, the supportiveness, you know, light duties. It was really nice. But my mind, it just wanted to keep going out to the world, you know, thinking of worldly issues that I was very sort of passionate about. You know, just things that I couldn't let go. And this sort of blocked my progress for a good month or two. No matter how I adjusted my technique, you know, no matter how I adjusted my lifestyle, I just couldn't really progress. And then I remembered... Now, I've read pretty much all the biography stories of the different senior monks, you know, from my tradition, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Mun, you know, a lot of these more famous monks, Ajahn Lee Dhammadaro, famous Thai kind of Kruba Ajahns. There's different biographies of these monks. And I remembered a lesson from Ajahn Chah. What he would do, which was quite unique, he would also be practicing in the forest, and on his walking path in the forest, he was so far away from everybody that when he spoke, nobody could hear him. And whenever he had some really difficult attachment that came up in his mind, he would ask himself, okay, why am I stuck on this? Why is this such a thing for me, you know? What's up with this? Where did this view come from? How did I get stuck, you know? And so he would like talk it through, and it was almost like an interrogation. You know what I mean? He'd sort of interrogate himself. Well, why is this such a big deal? Why do you, you know? Nobody else seems to care about this thing. You know, things like this. He would ask himself these questions, these very probing questions. And he would sort of talk himself out of these attachments in this way. Sometimes the suttas even use this term, to interrogate or investigate. You'd be surprised. In the culture of ancient India, they had a very healthy debate culture where you could, you know, you could ask anything like this. You know, if you went to a senior monk to ask about the Dhamma or whatever, or these different wanderers, they would meet in these wanderers' parks, and they would challenge each other as to their beliefs and their doctrines, and one needed to be capable of defending one's views from criticism. Ancient Greece had this too. Just as an aside, a lot of Western culture owes its character back to the Greek philosophers like Plato and Socrates. So they're sort of the original philosophers who, they were big into like interrogating and investigating and challenging people about their views. Like back in ancient Greece, they believed in gods like Zeus and Athena and, you know, all these Greek gods, right? And so Socrates and Plato, they would challenge people like, oh, so yeah, have you ever met Zeus in person? Are you sure he exists? I don't see him. Where is he? And also they would ask these really uncomfortable questions, and they would really bother people. Like, people hated them. People hated their guts because they were quite, you know, blunt about stuff like that. You know, if you're wondering why Westerners are so blunt about things, this is why, okay? This is where it comes from. Yeah, it's very un-Chinese, okay? Where harmony is a very important value, you know, in all Southeast Asian culture, there's this value of harmony, harmony, harmony. By the way, there's a very, very sensible reason why harmony is so important in Southeast Asian culture. There's a psychologist who wondered this question, well, why, you know, why is harmony so important? The reason is, when you look at how rice farming is done, Southeast Asia has, of course, rice farming as its staple food. And when it comes time to do the irrigation of the fields, every family, all these farms living next door, you 100% must be getting along with your neighbors in order to open the irrigation gates all at the same time and let the water on the fields. And then you also have to, you know, you let the water sit for a while, and then you must drain that water back off again, all at the same time. Everybody must cooperate. If you don't drain the water off properly, it'll get salty and kill the soil. The soil will get all salty. So this irrigation thing, you must have harmony with all your neighbors. So the land you live on forced you to be harmonious that way, forced you to survive. Whereas Westerners who don't do this rice farming, they grow wheat or whatever, you know, oats, they don't have to do this irrigation thing. So they can afford to argue with their neighbors. And you don't need this harmony so much. You know, you can go to your neighbor and argue about religion and politics and like these really hot topics, you know, these controversial topics. And then you're, and you know, maybe your neighbor likes a different political party and hates your guts and, you know. But that's okay, because you each have your own land and you might only see them once in a while when you go to the town or something. So that permitted Westerners to argue more because they could get away with it. Anyway, so in ancient India, same thing. They, so that area, I think, where the Buddha comes from, if I'm not mistaken, wheat is their staple there in that northern India, if I'm not mistaken. Someone might correct me on this, but I'm fairly sure it is wheat fields there in that area just to the south of Nepal. You know, they call it Bihar now. Bihar, that area of India, I believe is wheat. Anyway, so they had kind of like this debate culture, you know, where they could... And when you read the suttas, the Buddha is like this expert debater. Like he's so good at arguing points or, you know, questioning or whatever. Super good. Anyway, I took some philosophy in university myself, and you know, and I can be this very logical, rational kind of person. So that's something I loved about the Buddha, was he was so good at that. He's great at debating. Anyway, so here I was in Sri Lanka, and I had, you know, like I say, I was stuck in my practice. And so I started to copy Ajahn Chah. I copied this technique of asking myself, okay, well, you know, why am I stuck on this thing? And where did this view come from anyway? How did this all start? You know, it was that one friend of mine way back 10 years ago, 20 years ago, who introduced me to this thing, and then I really liked it, and, you know. But what if that friend didn't introduce me? He could have just as easily not said anything, or I could have maybe never had him as a friend, you know, met a different friend and found something different. It's all pretty arbitrary, right? Like, to me, it seems very important, but it's actually kind of arbitrary what I was exposed to and kind of cottoned onto, meaning like to really kind of seize hold of, you know? Anyway, so that helped a lot. Now here we are on a silent retreat, and you know, there's not really enough space for all of us to have a place to walk and do this. But what I do want to suggest is you might want to do this in the future sometime if you're walking alone in a park or something, nobody's around, or you know. Sometimes it can help to just say this kind of stuff out loud, and it really helps to cut through a bunch of chattery thoughts to kind of, like when you speak something out, it forces you to say it in a linear and like crystallized way, a concise way, you know, instead of a bunch of jumbled thoughts. Anyway, so that helped me a lot. So anyway, this, when I did this, in Sri Lanka, I could kind of talk myself out of my attachments, usually. And sometimes it took half an hour or an hour. I could kind of like challenge myself to see it from different perspectives. You know, is it really that important? Is it really so, you know, worth attaching to? Because I'm not enjoying my meditation, you know? Would I be willing to let go of that thing if I could enjoy my meditation 10 times more? You know what I mean? I'd ask myself questions like this. I'd be like, well, of course I'd let go, because nobody's rewarding me for holding on to this. Nobody's going to bring me a trophy or a medal or some money or something because I'm holding on to this issue. Nobody's rewarding me for this. But if I let go of it, well, then I might enjoy my meditation more, you know? And yeah, so basically when I could change my views, and usually there was a shift in my emotions around it, you know what I mean? It took some convincing, but I could kind of like shift my emotional perspective on it. There'd be a change of emotion. And I could kind of see, yeah, I'm actually being too uptight about this thing. You know, I'm being kind of foolish about this thing. And when I was able to do that shifting on an emotional level, that helped tremendously. And then I would go and sit down and meditate, and it was way easier. It'd be like 10 times as easy. I go sit down, and like that was some of the best meditating I ever had. So that little trick I learned from a John Cha really helped. And this is in the suttas. They call this Dhamma Vicaya, or investigation of Dhamma. Okay, so like I say, this is a silent retreat, and you know, there's not really enough room here for us to all be talking out loud, and you know, we're going to disturb each other, but you know, you can do it in your mind somewhat, silently, right? Yeah, like if you're doing, let's say, walking meditation, and there's some issue stuck in your mind, just ask yourself silently, you know, why am I stuck on this? Or where did this come from? Or, you know what I mean? Yeah, you're totally allowed to do this. And the only warning is... Now, there are people who will overthink things, okay? They might think too much about things. And if we spend too long doing it, it can wear us down, okay? It actually costs more energy than you might realize to do all that thinking. And by the end of the day, you're going to be real tired. You're going to want to go to bed early. So my advice is, don't overuse it, okay? You know you've done a good job. If you can kind of change your emotional attitude towards something in a way where you feel like, yeah, you know what? I feel like I've kind of resolved that, you know? I can kind of move on now. I can kind of move on. You know what I mean? When you feel that feeling that you can move on now, emotionally, okay, good. That's what you were wanting to achieve by it. And you'd be surprised. That can tremendously help meditation sometimes. Because once one can emotionally put something down, then when one sits down to meditate, the mind is ready to cooperate. The mind's ready to go silent. The mind's like, okay, fine, let's meditate then. And it's like more cooperative, you know what I mean? It's just ready to cooperate with your intention for your object of meditation. Okay, so that's that I feel is one of the methods that we must sometimes use, especially if we are stuck on something that comes up in the mind again and again. Maybe you keep thinking about some person, or there's some world issue you're just so passionate about, and you know, you feel like, well, why am I here on this meditation retreat? And, you know, it's selfish of me to not be doing my part to solve this problem, you know? Things like this. Sometimes we have to get ourselves unstuck, you know, this way. But we don't really have anyone else to talk to about it. It's nice to have somebody to listen and, you know, we can talk to. A good friend will be a good listener about this kind of stuff. But if we don't have that, we can use this Dhamma Vicaya.